there, Suna. And what was that little noise? I heard a little noise. Dum-dum-ba-ba-bum. We've got screens up to our ears here, trying to do a good job. So anyway, here we are with our 90-minute Ed August's World, and thank you for being here the first time, and thank you if you are coming back. For your information, the intention with this show is mostly to go into books and book collecting, because that's my target interest, the thing that I do in my spare time. And I just love books, and I've spoken before how I got into books when I was 6 or 7 years old, and I inherited my brother's book collection when he enlisted in the U.S. Navy. So I had hundreds and hundreds of books around me as I was just a cherub. But it was a good education, you know. By the time I was in like the third and the fourth grade, teacher brought up subjects in social studies or, you know, the history of the American Revolution or the Indians or whatever. And it was like, oh, I know that stuff, you know, I know that stuff. I inhaled it by spending long summers alone in that room looking, thumbing through hundreds of books. And of course, kids have learned through osmosis, too. Sometimes they just pick up a book and they just feel it. They heft the book in their arms. They look at some of the illustrations, you know, and they basically consume that information through some kind of weird psychic, you know, telekinesis or something. But but anyways, I do have other interests other than books. One of them is music. And somewhere here I have a number of my musical selections, which some are done on keyboard and others are done on acoustic guitar. But I think we're not going to have too many of those today. But let's see. You know, I mean, you know, they're kind of like little jingles. They average out to be about 2 minutes long. And that's because then I can make MP3s out of them and send them to my friends or anybody, you know, that wants them. Oh, I don't know. Okay. You're talking me into it. I really should probably play at least one song here. For all of you who are here and don't know why you're here, or you're here and I love it that you're here, here is It Had to Be You. Let's see. Thank you. Here's a book that I'm writing. It's called Books That Influenced My Young Life. I have it in .odt, so I would have to work on a little bit before I get it into PDF for docs or anything like that. But, you know, I was referring to my childhood, and it really was an interesting time. Let me see here. We'll do a little something specific, and then we'll get into more general stuff later. Now I'm just trying to get to the top of the page. You can see why they have 5 or 6 technicians, you know, on the networks, because what one of them, you know, misses, the other one catches. So let's see here. What did I say about this stuff anyway? Anyway, it was a delight to grow up around books. And there are books that I remember from 1958, 1959. One of them from that era was David and the Phoenix. Did anybody remember seeing that book? It was a it was what you could call, I think it was Children's Book Club, but I'm not sure. It's by David Ormondroyd. Ormondroyd sounds like a fancy name for a phoenix or something from a book of mythology. It's a story of how David decided one day to go up to the mountain behind his house, and how he went up and up. I'd never been up a mountain before. And there, somewhere near the top, happening upon a talking phoenix. I don't know what to make of the phoenix. I didn't know what to make of the phoenix. It was a new creature entirely. The closest thing to the phoenix were the chickens they used to peck about in the yard. When my parents got to America, and they had this big ranch house where my dad was trading his work for free rent in the house, there was, as I said, big yards. And so one of the things they got one day, they brought home chickens, little tiny yellow chicken muffins, you know, just barely out of the egg. And I remember them being under some hot lights in the barn for a while. And then pretty soon they were pecking around in the backyard. So we had 100 chickens in the yard. I think that's the only animal, the only birds that I remember, at least on such an intimate basis, you know. I remember my mom used to go into where they had their little nesting area, and the birds would be all distracted, you know, as she was basically, you know, reaching under them and picking out an egg, you know, and the birds were not too happy about that, and she would do that almost every day. Anyway, I remember those chickens well. We also had one rooster, and that's where I learned about the word henpecked, because he really got it bad. I don't know how he got into these fights over these female chickens, but, you know, being the one male in the area was a bad job, because he really took it on the chin. Anyway, back to the phoenix. I believe the phoenix started taking David on various adventures to distant destinations. Just, you know, hang on his back and the bird would fly away. I at some point I got tired of the book because I realized it was all too contrived. I just didn't believe in the existence of this large, dorky-looking blue, purple, and orange bird, every bit as big as Phoenix. Little David accessed the Phoenix by climbing up a steep little hill. At that time, the idea of climbing a mountain or hill was very strange to me because we didn't live near any hills of any kind. Although we did drive across the Santa Cruz Mountains once in a while to Santa Cruz and places like that. If we had lived near a mountain, I surely would have wanted to climb up and see if there were any mythological monsters, creatures nesting there. The second one I mentioned is Droll Stories by Honoré de Balzac. Imagine my delight as a young boy to open my brother's Droll Stories. It was a cheap version, possibly even a book club edition, but more likely one of those privately printed by the Siren Press or similar. Red covers, not cloth, but just boards. I must have gone through all my brother's books, one by one, looking for nuggets like this one. Here was my first experience of seeing line drawings, slightly comical, slightly erotic, illustrations, one of a maiden pressed, or maybe she was a maiden, maybe not, maiden pressed up against the back of a man on horseback, another, a picture that brought such infinite delight that I would take it down, stare and stare at it with great pleasure, then at the slightest sound of footsteps, put it back up again into its shelf. This was just another black and white drawing of a page from the court of some Middle Ages mansion or castle where a teenage lad, let's say, is kneeling at the foot of a damsel. Possibly she's a princess or a lady, sitting in a chair, feigning sleep with a wan smile on her face as the boy is positioned in such a way that he can just see up her dress. We can't quite see what he sees, but we can tell that he can. He's delighted and he's tempted. Not only that, his hand reaches out. He's just about to touch her. She sits with the legs just slightly spread, so from his point of view, he can see her. I must say something about me or my family or the curiously wise ways of youngsters that even as a 7 or 8 year old, I caught the expectant desire in the damsel and the tentative, hesitant ardor of the page who scoped out the object of concern in his drawing. And I wondered, what was the young and enamored page do next? Would he embrace her leg? Would he kiss her? What was he going to do? I wasn't sure what to expect in a one-on-one encounter like that. But even at that early age, I definitely determined that that area, that is to say of the woman's legs, was of prime importance. Oh, dear. Maybe I should not get into this, Michelle. This is going to be a heck of a book when it comes out because there's all kinds of interesting books. Well, anyway, so now imagine my delight when I found a copy of this exact edition at a yard sale last week. And this is something that I added very recently. So this actually did happen. Maybe it was actually more like a month ago. Thumbing through it brought back some good memories. Yeah, I can remember how my pulse raced and how frightened I was that somebody would walk in as I was reading it. But my fears were never to be realized. Not in Santa Clara, not with that book. But I could see that this could be, you know, a dangerous situation to put someone in. And, you know, maybe my dad or mom should have looked more carefully through the library of books before they had me stay there. I don't think that it even occurred to them that there was something that could have been naughty or whatever, you know, there. Oh, yeah, yeah. It goes on, let's see. I had no clue the illustrator was someone named Steel Savage. That fact totally bypassed me in 1956 or whenever the heck it was. So I'm not going to sell that book because that book sells. That book brings back, you know, some memories. And here's the accurate description of the book. Balzac, Honoré de Balzac, Droll Stories. Blue Ribbon Books, New York, 1946, hardcover. Red cloth covers with faded gilt spine lettering and designs, illustrated with suggestive and naughty black and white drawings by Steel Savage. No dust jacket. A pretty thing at that, with the pictures perfectly pinioned to the prolific Parisian's prose. Hey, that's pretty good, huh? With the pictures perfectly pinioned to the prolific Parisian's prose. No dust jacket, $24.50. Going along with that is Boccaccio's Decameron, an edition that is now unremembered because I saw it. I didn't even remember about when this came out. It was about 1900. It was, you know, a book that was at least 100 years old now. This was another mildly erotic hardcover, an illustrated book, not nearly so obvious as the Droll Stories, but liltingly similar. These continental damsels were not dressed in any kind of Victorian style of the age, that was for sure. And of course, that's why so many of the English had, you know, the continental journeys, that they went to places like Italy and France and the Netherlands, you know, where and Greece, you know, where lifestyles were different, and the sight of a woman's ankle was not forbidden, you know, as they were in Victorian times in England. So I found another copy of this same book in some books that somebody had brought me when I had a bookstore in Tucson on Grant Road. This was an edition about 20 years earlier, but this was there was a difference here. Someone had collected this book, and sure, there were 12 or 13 plates, you know, like lithographs of, you know, some semi-clad young ladies and stuff. But this edition, around 1880, whoever this guy was, it's got to be a guy, he had pasted vast numbers of drawings and pictures and plates and newspaper from newspapers and magazines, maybe even some books. He had scissored these, he had disbound them and pasted them into various places. In this book, from the front end and back end papers, and to all the front and back. Yeah, well, that's what you call them, the front and then back end papers. Those are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 blank pages. Well, there might be the half title. The half title would just have the title of the book and nothing else. But he did this all the way down to the copyright page. And in between the introduction and where the real book started, he had glued it with native girls of the kind of Pocahontas kind, you know, what would be romantically, how they would be romantically visioned in the mid or late 19th century. Amazons, we're familiar with Amazons, the tribe of warlike females that would slay and defeat, you know, the men that came against them. Magdalens, yes, there were even pictures of Mary Magdalene with like a plunging bodice or something. Well, after all, she was supposed to be the fallen woman. She was the only fallen woman I can think of in the Bible, in the New Testament anyway. French dancers, can-can dancers, go-go, dance hall girls of the era. Some were religious in nature, and others were tokens from the days of the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece and Rome. So how amazing, I write, I had discovered someone's treasure trove of what passed for erotica in those days. They were not really naughty pictures by today's standards. There was no genitalia, male or female, but there were lots and lots of bosoms and bust lines. And every once in a while, Venus at her toilette with a Cupid or cherub or two. So finding this book made me feel like I had gone back to my childhood, because that's the kind of thing I saw in my childhood. Oh no, you shouldn't say that. And I go on in books that influenced my young life with Encyclopedia Britannica World Atlas. Okay, that's got to be boring. We're not going to even go to that one. Okay, Essays of Montaigne, illustrated by Salvador Dali. There was a strange, perverse joy that I felt whenever I picked this book up and slowly perused its contents. The illustrations really made the book. The book was the book inspired a lifelong love of Salvador Dali, though I found his lesser works easier to look at than his florid, often gainly insect-covered paintings. You know, the kind that have melting watches over the limbs of cactuses and stuff like that. Was Dali just the first of many self-aggrandizing artists who found that the more he tore himself down by acting a clown or a fool, the more he built up his reputation, his career? And he definitely did that. He acted the fool. He had that ridiculous little mustache that stuck out about, you know, 6 inches on both sides of his lips with a twirl on the end, you know. He did have great abilities as a visionary artist, but he was not just selling the paintings, he was selling himself. There is the striking painting of his, which is of a crescent moon that is really someone's face rising above the ocean horizon. And there's someone in front of it who's like kneeling down and looking at it across the water. As I recall, it is a scary moon face, a literal man in the moon, but then in brilliant yellow with a horrid geometry. That's right, there's a kind of celestial geometry there, because the universe is made out of geometry, isn't it? Spheres and, you know, what can be more geometric than the sphere of the sun or the moon or the planets? I remember the feeling as a child, the geometry is supposed to make this foul, bizarre moon drawing all right. But isn't quite all right. It's not the moon, it's a man. For there's a real man attached, and he is rising too from the water. This was at a time when I didn't even know what geometry was, let alone sacred geometry, which sometimes goes into, you know, alchemy and astrology and things like that. I don't know. Let's see. Faust, or Dr. Faustus, was an oblong cartoon book that dated from the 1950s. My goodness, you know, when I look at this, I'm having a hard time finding books that would have been appropriate for my age, because the story in Faust is that Mephistopheles an obliging demon, almost passable as a human, seduces the academic, you know, and magical Faust with promises of adventure, excitement, love, and glory. An apt pupil for such fun, Faust, under the tutelage of the evil one, meets, seduces, and then abandons the preciously innocent and sweet, or Marguerite, as I think the original called her. A battle for her soul occurs in which she can go with Faust to hell or be with the angels in heaven. This is one round which Mephistopheles loses, and Faust is heartbroken to have her wrenched away from him by angels sent by God, who ascend with her up into the vaults of heaven. So what a strange story, you know, for an eight-year-old. Maybe I was eight by then, maybe I was nine, I don't know, something like that. And this was all done in very simple cartoons, very simple cartoon panels. And I don't know if I should have seen something like that. From then to now, a series of children's books in the Little Golden Books series that featured wonderful color illustrations. The one I still recall had a brontosaurus on the cover. You know, I had a real fascination with dinosaurs back in those days. Well, what kid, what boy or girl doesn't get really intrigued with dinosaurs from the first time they see them, you know? The fascination with this book led me to have a series of dreams in which several large dinosaurs visited my orchard neighborhood. At first, I could just see the big footprints they had left behind in the soft earth, but soon I could see the whole dinosaur 50 to 100 feet long. After the brontosaurus, it was a tyrannosaurus or allosaurus. It was hulking around on its hind legs. For some reason, even though it had huge incisors, I wasn't as afraid of him as I was of the giant brontosaurus. I think the brontosaurus could have stepped on me, and that's probably why. In the end, when I woke up, I ran outside to look for footprints, and sure enough, I saw a few depressions in the earth that seemed to me to be from dinosaurs that must have tromped through the area while I was sleeping. So I was a lonely kid back in those days, and I was sad that they hadn't looked in on me. You know, if one of these dinosaurs, if the brontosaurus had looked in my window, then, you know, I would have been a very happy guy, kid indeed. Oh, I got to tell you this, and then probably we'll have a chance to go to just a little break. Great Tales of Terror and the Supernatural. That was probably one of my favorite books that I discovered. I don't think I got to this one until I was about 10 years old, maybe 11. It's a modern library giant dating from the 1940s, back when Bennett Cerf was in charge of Random House, you know. I was mesmerized and haunted by this book from the first time I picked it up. I remember that summer, there was a row of corn against our east fence, and the sun would mellow it into a green and gold color, lightly touched by the breeze, as I lay nearby reading the wonderful stories in this book. Although, you know, even at 10 or 11, this was not by any means an easy book to read. I tried, I got the gist of some of these stories. I got the atmosphere of some of these stories by attempting to read them. What child could escape being fond of a title like Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad? Yep, that's a story where someone goes to the seashore near some ruined monastery or something. Not a monastery, it could have been a place where, I don't know, it could have been anybody. But anyway, he finds this thing that says, it has on it in ancient lettering, which he just happens to be able to read because he's from the university, you know. These university folks, you know, they know how to read everything, even if it's in like a Middle English from 1,000 years ago. But anyway, that's what the inscription translated to is, whistle and I will come to you, my lad. What child could escape being fond of a title like that? Or escape being ravished by the storyline of a 1,000-year-old whistle found in the ruins of a building at the edge of the North Sea? A whistle which brings ghosts into one's home. That's right. When he did try to whistle with it one night as he was going to bed, well, I won't give away the ending of the story, but, you know, certainly that was worth reading about. Very atmospheric, you know. There's nothing like a story that can bring you to feel ancient mysteries by the shores of the North Sea. Another story in that book, Great Tales of Terror and the Supernatural, the Horla, H-O-R-L-A, about a ghost that attaches itself to a person and drives him mad. It's sort of like almost like, you know, the idea of having a monkey on your back or something. I think that's even used in this book. It's like something attaching itself just below the neck and hanging onto the back, you know, and the person can't get rid of it. But the finest stories to my thinking in this book were Rats in the Walls. I guess it's The Rats in the Walls by H.P. Lovecraft, the person from, I can't remember the capital city of Rhode Island. But anyway, in which a curious visitor's investigations into the sub-cellars of a stately old English mansion reveal many layers of historical and prehistorical worship and sacrifice. And what's interesting there is somebody comes, I think they come over from America to claim their inheritance, you know, and so they're sleeping one night and they hear this scratching, scritching noise, you know, in the walls. And wow, what the heck is that? It must be rats in the walls, right? So that's where you get the rats in the walls. But the rats always descend into a lower and lower region of the mansion. And it's there that there is a surprise waiting, because beneath this ancient mansion is the remains of a temple or some kind of building from a couple of thousand years ago, maybe the time of the Druids. And then below that temple is something even more ancient and frightening. Or the even better Dunwich Horror. That's the next book. That's the next title, the next story in this book, Great Tales of Terror and Supernatural, where an invisible creature is summoned up by the dread Necronomicon. Well, that's a book, huh? From an alien world, a world that is actually very close and lurking in the shadows. I have had an uncomfortable feeling about desolate places like the hills of northwestern Massachusetts ever since reading this book. And once, taking the train from Montreal to Manhattan, had a start when, in the middle of the night, I saw the blank eyes of dead buildings in rural Vermont staring, as it were, you know, at me as the train slowly went through the town. There was a big book in my brother's collection called Jean Christophe, C-H-R-I-S-T-O-P-H-E, by Romain Rolland, R-O-L-L-A-N-D, was a big, thick modern library classic. God, this is one of these 800-page books, you know? The copy I had dated from the 1930s. I was soon old enough to look on title pages and copyright pages. I could have probably determined if a book was a first edition or not by the time I was 8 years old, but I didn't know there was anything special about such a type of book, so I didn't ponder much about what I noticed. When I first noticed this book at the age of 7 or 8, I wasn't altogether sure whether the book was Jean Christophe by Romain Rolland or Romain Rolland by Jean Christophe. There wasn't much on the title page to help me decide which was which. The book seemed extremely notable to me, but I'm not sure why. The book was just so substantial. It was thick. It was heavy. It was chock full of absolutely zero illustrations, not one illustration. That impressed me tremendously as a young child, even though I didn't understand what it meant. Illustrations were very important to me in those days. The whole Holy Bible was an inscrutable darkness to me because some versions of it were not illustrated. It took my getting the illustrated version, which I got on my birthday probably at about that time, before I could really partake of the leavened bread and drink the Kool-Aid of the first... drink the Kool-Aid. Stop it. I'm being a little disrespectful here. Drink the Kool-Aid of the First or the Last Supper. But as it was in the matter of the content of Jean Christophe, I could not make heads or tails of it. It might as well have been written in French for all the good it did me. So despite the feeling of elevation it produced, the kind of sanctimonious feeling of wonderment at all this erudition and learning, all these long words and fancy phrases, the whole Modern Library Giants series was like that. Streamlined runner holding a torch was impressive to me. That was one of the symbols for Random House. Random House had other symbols. The Borzoi, a greyhound kind of dog, was quite impressive on the title page. Any book with a dashing torchbearer or the galloping Borzoi meant that it was a book good enough to be in my brother's mid-1950 book collection, and that meant I was absolutely fascinated. Well, this is a book that is not going to press. This is a book that is still on my computer. And now I'm going to move from one computer to the other. And I think we're gearing up to play a few little oddments for you, a few little goodies for you. Hopefully you'll enjoy them, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
Call in our live number at 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. Press 1 to participate on the air.
Please learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to freedomizerradio.com and also Facebook us right at freedomizerradio.com. Catch you there.
My name is Dr. Eric Norman. I have studied vitamin B12 deficiency for over 35 years. I have developed the urinary MMA test to detect tissue B12 deficiency early, allowing treatment and prevention of permanent disability. B12 deficiency can cause anemia, but also neurologic problems such as spinal cord degeneration, paranoia, and dementia. B12 is found only in animal sources, so vegetarians become deficient. As people age, they may not produce enough stomach acid or intrinsic factor protein for absorption of B12 and become deficient. Up to 10% of seniors may have a normal serum B12 level, but a tissue B12 deficiency causing a 3 times greater risk for heart attack, stroke, or Alzheimer's. For more information, visit B12.com.
Are you looking for a new place to shop, eat, and save? Are you sick of paying full price? Would you like to save money at the places you enjoy most? Well, here's a popular savings book that is full of coupons catered to your local area. It's called Save Around. This book is full of exclusive discounts to help you save money around your town. Yes, that's Save Around. You will save money at restaurants, department stores, cars, even flowers. When I take my family out, there are 7 of us. The average meal was about $110 to $140. Last time I took them out, and I'm holding a copy of the receipt right here, the check originally was $120. With the Save Around book, our meal cost $82 at a place we go to quite often. Who knew? And there are a few places we found that we are going to check out. View the books in your area before you buy. Go to freedomizerradio.com or barefootislegal.org. Just click on your city, and within a few days, you will be saving money around town with your new Save Around book.
Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is vaccine rights attorney and Freedomizer Radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
Tune in to the Mad Scientist Expo Show every Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific, where we discuss the science and the news today, take a closer look, and expose where fraud is being committed for various agendas, from money to politics to downright pure evil and malice. Of course we trust science. It's scientists we don't trust. Tune in and join the conversation on Tuesday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific, on Freedomizer Radio.
Hello, and we're back. And I discovered a book among my books that I had not noticed in about 10 years. It's called The Doubtful Guest, and it's by Edward Gorey, G-O-R-E-Y. And the only way to describe Edward Gorey is he's kind of like Charles Adams and was roughly contemporaneous with him. I used to know which one came first, Charles Adams or Edward Gorey. This is a book from Doubleday and Company, Garden City, New York, 1957. It's an oblong hardcover book with a dust jacket on it. The Doubtful Guest is this strange creature that he almost looks like a penguin, but with a sharp, jagged beak and kind of like just white, blank eyes. And he's got flippers instead of hands, but he walks on 2 legs, and he's got tennis shoes on his feet. And each one of these verses here is accompanied by a two-line, passage of poetry. When they answered the bell on that wild winter night, there was no one expected and no one in sight. It's a picture of the three people that came out the door. They're looking around. They don't see anybody there that knocked on the door. Then they saw something standing on top of an urn whose peculiar appearance gave them quite a turn. So they're all of a sudden they notice that there's this big, fancy, kind of like architectural urn, like made out of concrete or something. And there is this weird beast. And the beast has a shawl around its neck also. So it's got a shawl and staring at them, and they don't know what to make of it. What can you make of a creature like that? All at once it leapt down and ran into the hall, where it chose to remain with its nose to the wall. Yep, there's a picture of it with its nose to the wall, so it's not bothering anybody. And the people are querying. There's obviously the lord of the manor and the lady, and there's a small boy, and there's someone else who could be like maybe a butler or maybe a daughter or something. It was seemingly deaf to whatever they said, so at last they stopped screaming and went off to bed. So there it is with its nose still, or its beak still fixed on the wall, and they're going up the stairs, the second story of this mansion, to spend the night. It joined them at breakfast and presently ate all the syrup and toast and part of a plate. And there it is, chewing on a plate. So I guess the poor thing doesn't know any better. And the rest of the people are gathered, they're sitting in their normal chairs and everything, having a nice formal breakfast. It wrenched off the horn from the new gramophone and could not be persuaded to leave it alone. So here's the beast holding the part of the horn part, that the music comes out of, and they're trying to coax it back, trying to get it back, but he's not getting it back. It betrayed a great liking for peering up flues and for peeling the soles of its white canvas shoes. Well, there it is, looking up the flue of the fireplace. I don't know what he thinks he's going to see there. At times it would tear out whole chapters from books or put roomfuls of pictures askew on their hooks. So he did things to pictures on the walls, and there's pages being scattered that he's tearing out of books. Every Sunday it brooded and laid on the floor inconveniently close to the dining room door. Also, it was brooding on the floor, just lay on the floor on its face, so they had a very hard time getting into and out of the drawing room. Now and then it would vanish for hours from the scene, but alas, it was discovered inside a tureen. Oh, brother. Okay, so there's a big tureen. He's laying on his back on it, so it's like a bathtub. It was subject to fits and bewildering wrath, during which it would hide all the towels from the bath. Well, I can't describe all these things. Here he is walking away with all the towels from the bathroom. In the night through the house, it would aimlessly creep in spite of the fact of its being asleep. So it was a sleepwalking monster or creature. Don't worry, folks, we're getting near the end of the book. It would carry off objects of which it grew fond and protect them by dropping them into the pond. Oh, dear. So he had like somebody's wristwatch. No, it's like one of those gold watches with a chain, and he's throwing it into the frozen pond. It came 17 years ago, and to this day it has shown no intention of going away. So all these people are getting elderly, quite old, and it's still sitting there like it owns the place. At the end it says, also by Edward Gorey, The Unstrung Harp and The Listing Attic. The Listing Attic? An attic that lists. I think listening is sort of like going back and forth, like rocking back and forth, back and forth. So I looked up this book, and in this condition, this particular first edition is $135. Can you imagine that? I mean, I think that's more than Charles Adams books, unless maybe they were autographed. Well, one notion that I had was to go through a box of books and go book by book by book, and have it like be an adventurous, attempt to look up prices and to see if there's something in that box that might intrigue you, that might be of interest. And because I can practically tell a tale I can write and tell a tale with any and every book. And people ask me, when I say I have thousands of books, have you read all those books? Oh, well, at least three different people came into my last bookstore, well, several bookstores, actually, and they would look around and they'd say, man, have you read all these books? Well, no, but I did have a hand in collecting them, and I only put stuff up on the shelves that I thought are cool, you know, things that I could, if I was on a desert island, you know, I could go through, I'd go through any of these books, maybe time and time and time again. I'd probably end up memorizing books if I was on a desert island. So somehow or other, perhaps because I was growing up in an orchard, and, you know, I'm a big guy, I'm a normal guy, but somehow I got intrigued with poetry. Maybe I was exposed to poetry at an early age, too. Although, you know what? I don't remember any poems in particular from my brother's collection. Not really. Not at all. And yet, somewhere, somehow, someplace, I got drawn into the world of poetry. And before I knew it, I was writing quite a bit of it. I think my first book was Deaths of an Orchard, and I published it myself at Gestetner Mimeograph Company in downtown San Jose, where they were kind enough to let me use the mimeograph. They showed me how to use it, so I actually put the book together myself. Then they thankfully collated it for me. They collated it for free and stapled it for free. And so that is Deaths of an Orchard, which is now kind of a hard book to find because I did it when I was about 16 or 17 years old, and it is scattered to the far winds. If you look Ed Augusts and look to see if there's a book by that title, you may find it. You may also find Summer Poems, which came out the next year, and Can Earthquakes Be Predicted? By EA, I was just using my initials on it because that was kind of scandalous at the time for someone to talk about astrology in relation to scientific subject like earthquakes. I was perhaps one of the first people that ever wrote about using astrology to predict earthquakes. And, we'll go into that sometime on my other show. My other show is Ed August Psychic Astrologer, and that's on not the Freedomizer radio brand, but just on Blog Talk Radio, and that is a 30-minute show. That one, sometimes we have call-ins. Here, I don't really see the point of call-ins. We did have a gentleman who called in last week and basically read me a book list that he wanted me to look up. I can do that every once in a while, but I'd much prefer if you just email me, ed@edaugusts.com. Just email me, ed@edaugusts.com, and present whatever it is. I buy, sell, and trade books. I have books of every genre. Most of them are put away in some storage lockers right now. I think it'll take me about a year to go through the books in my storage lockers so that I can put them up on the web and list them. It's not easy because the process is getting them out of the locker, opening up a box, taking a book, looking it up on all the databases that are online, and, you know, according to the author, the title, the publisher, the edition, the place it was published, the date of the book, whether it's a first edition or not, whether it's got any special thing like if it's signed and inscribed by the author or, you know, other things, or if it has a $100 bill in it. I know people who have found money in books. I know one book dealer, at least, who, when he takes books from you, he rifles through the whole book. He just takes it and goes like that from start to finish. And it's because he doesn't want to end up with somebody's book that might have something rare or valuable in it, you know, some certificate, some letter, or some large piece of money. I think the most I've ever found in a book was 100 marks bill from Germany. Someone said, well, the mark is no longer the currency in Germany, so the currency is worthless because they had gone over to the euro. And then, of course, later I found, but of course, you can redeem that. 100 marks is still worth 100 marks. So I don't know. It was questionable enterprise. But, you know, it's always good to look through books for that very reason. There might be something good in there. You know what? I'm trying to backtrack and find in my mind what was the start of that story I told. I'm not sure I know what the start of the story was I was just telling. So here we have a book called 60 Years of American Poetry. Let's see. Wood engravings throughout. Oh, this is a library book. This has the library stamps, you know, and it has a thing on the cover with the access number and all that. So who do they have in this book of poetry? Because that is that's right. I was saying that I had gotten into poetry somehow as a kid, and I think that's what people thought of me as for 5 or 6 years. And then at some point, I got married, and soon after, or soon before I got married, I realized, wait a minute, I can't help, you know, pay for my marriage, help pay for having a wife and a place to live and everything. As a poet, you know, there's probably 3 poets in the whole world at any one time pay their bills because of their poetry or their books. So I was persuaded that I had spent at least 5 or 6 years in going up the wrong creek, you know, without a paddle. But I still have a kind of a love. I still have, I think, a love for poetry. The first poet in this book is Edward Arnold Robinson. Isn't that his name? E.A. Robinson? Edward Arnold. Oh, boy. I wonder if they have it extended anywhere here. You know, I know of E.A. Robinson, but I'm just not sure. Okay. That's probably not his name. I used to know these things. Daniel Berrigan. Let's see. What order are they in? They're in order of, I think, the person's birthday. Mm-hmm. 2 pages sticking together. Otherwise, they would have been there already. The poems. No, they just want to say E.A. Robinson. There's no way to even figure out what his name is from calling him that. Edward Arlington Robinson, something like that. Oh, my God, I feel so foolish. Just don't know his name. I used to know it in about 1965. This is for a dead lady. No more with overflowing light shall fill the eyes that now are faded, nor shall another's fringe with night their woman-hidden world as they did. Now, wait a second. Let me stop right there. I thought this was a rhyming poem. Let's try that again. No more with overflowing light shall fill the eyes that now are faded, nor shall another's fringe with night their woman-hidden world as they did. No, it still doesn't rhyme. No more shall quiver down the days the flowing wonder of her ways, whereof no language may requite the shifting and the many shaded. Okay, so it rhymes every other quatrain. The grace, divine, definitive, clings only as a faint forestalling. The laugh that love could not forgive is hushed and answers to no calling. The forehead and the little ears have gone where Saturn keeps the years. The breast where roses could not live has done with rising and with falling. The beauty shattered by the laws that have creation in their keeping no longer trembles at applause or over children that are sleeping. And we who delve in beauty's lore know all that we have known before of what inexorable cause makes time so vicious in his reaping. Well, ain't it the truth? Time is a bitch. And probably I should have read that poem before reading it. Here's one by Leonora Speyer, S-P-E-Y-E-R, called Swans. See, where I think we're going to go is go from poems at the start of this book, that is 100 years ago, when there was more meter and more rhyme, to books that don't try to be quite so beautiful, and lift our spirits into more and more poems that are worldly, and that basically like tell a story, set a scene, you know, like a little act in a play. If you been to a poetry reading in the last 40 years, that's what they do. They get up there, and it's like you're watching a one-act play on Broadway or something, and you can't even hardly tell it's a poem that they're speaking. I'm not familiar with this one, Leonora Speyer. Something attracted me to it. With wings held close and slim neck bent, along dark water scarcely stirred, floats glimmering and indolent the alabaster bird. Floats near its mate, the lovely one, they lie like snow, cool flake on flake, mild breast on breast of dimmer swan, dim mirrored in the lake. They glide and glides that white embrace, shy bird to bird with never a sound. Thus leaned Narcissus towards his face, leaned lower till he drowned. Leda leaned thus, subdued and spent beneath those vivid wings of love, along the lake, proud, indolent, the vast birds scarcely move. Silence is wisdom, then how wise are these whose song is but their knell. A god did well to choose this guise, truly a god did well. So this goes into the myth of Leda and the swan. Wasn't Leda turned? Oh, yeah, that's right. Leda was this beautiful lady, and the swan was Zeus, who appeared to her in that guise. There's a story there that probably should be on a different channel of the radio. E.E. Cummings. I had a buddy in high school who loves E.E. Cummings because there was no punctuation, no capitalization, no punctuation, nothing at all. This is early E.E. Cummings. You know, this book really is a miserable book because they only give one poem for each poet. So that's how they can stick 250 poets into the book. But, you know, you really don't get a real representation of what it's like. Do I want to read about my father moved through dunes of love by E.E. Cummings? My father moved through dunes of love, through sames of am, through halves of give, singing each morning, out of each night, my father moved through depths of height. This motionless, forgetful where turned at his glance to shining here, that if so timid air is firm, under his eyes would stir and squirm. Nearly as from unburied witch floats the first who, his April touch, drove sleeping selves to swarm their fates, woke dreamers to their ghostly roots. And should some why completely weep, my father's fingers brought her sleep. Vainly no smallest voice might cry, for he could feel the mountains grow. Lifting the valleys of the sea, my father moved through griefs of joy, praising a forehead called the moon, singing desire into begin. Joy was a song and joy so pure, a heart of star by him could steer, and pure so now and now so yes, the wrists of twilight would rejoice. Keen as midsummer's keen beyond conceiving mind of sun will stand, so strictly over utmost him, so hugely stood my father's dream. His flesh was flesh, his blood was blood, so no hungry man but wished him food. No cripple wouldn't creep 1 mile uphill to only see him smile. Scorning the pomp of must and shall, my father moved through dunes of feel. His anger was as right as rain, his pity was as green as grain. Septembering arms of year extend, less humbly wealth to foe and friend, than he to foolish and to wise offered immeasurable is. Proudly and by octobering flame beckoned, as earth will downward climb, so naked for immortal work, his shoulders marched against the dark. His sorrow was as true as bread. No liar looked him in the head. If every friend became his foe, he'd laugh and build a world with snow. Wow, was he talking about his father? Was he talking about God? Oh, my God, there's another page. I'm sorry. My father moved through days of we, singing each new leaf out of each tree, and every child was sure that spring danced when she heard my father sing. Then let men kill which cannot share, let blood and flesh be mud and mire, scheming imagined, passion willed, freedom a drug that's bought and sold. Giving to steal and cruel kind, a heart to fear, to doubt a mind, to differ a disease of same, conform the pinnacle of am. Though dull were all we taste as bright, bitter all utterly things sweet, maggoty minus and dumb death, all we inherit, all bequeath. And nothing quite so least is truth. I say, though hate were why men grieve, because my father lived his soul, love is the whole and more than all. So I guess that is a paean to his late father. There are so many poems in here that I'm poets that I'm just not familiar with, but you know, I think we've got to look. This one might be a little bit different. It's got a certain joyousness to it, I think. By Edward Field. It's called Mae West. Do you remember Mae West? I'm a little older, and I may be remembering, you know, figures from that I saw in movies that date from the 40s, from the 30s, from 1930s, maybe early 40s. Kind of a Marilyn Monroe type. But she's known for that, you know, puts her hand on the hip and looks back at the guy and says, why don't you come up and see me sometime, you know? And she goes back to the 1890s, I think. I think she probably was known on Broadway, 1890s. Vaudeville, maybe she was part of the Ziegfeld Follies. I should know these kind of things, but I know them partly, but not entirely. Mae West. She comes on drenched in a perfume called self-satisfaction, from feather boa to silver pumps. She does not need to be loved by you, though she'll give you credit for good taste. Just because you say you love her, she's not throwing herself at your feet in gratitude. Every other star reveals how worthless she feels by crying when the hero says he loves her, or how unhoped for the approval is when the audience applauds her big number. But Mae West takes it as her due. She knows she's good. She expects the best for herself and knows she's worth what she costs, and she costs plenty. She's not giving anything away. She enjoys her admirers, fat daddy or muscle man, and don't confuse vanity and sex, though she never turns down pleasure, lapping it up. Above all, she enjoys herself, swinging her body that says, me, 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 me. Why not have a good time? So long as you amuse me, go on. I like you slobbering over my hand, big boy. I have a right to. Most convincing, we all know this, not by her preaching it presence. It's no act. Every word and look and movement spells independence. She likes being herself. And we who don't can only look on astonished. Yeah, hey, there's people that don't like themselves, huh? So... yeah, what interesting lady. And I believe that Mae West went through several marriages, maybe six or seven marriages, and she ended up still appearing in movies, or was it also stage appearances, until she was like in her 90s. So she wasn't going to let go of that life force. She was, Galway Kinnell. Is there a Irish, note in that name? Galway, which is a province of Ireland. Kinnell, K-I-N-N-E-L-L. St. Francis and the Sow. What the heck? St. Francis and the Sow. I like St. Francis. I don't know what the Sow has to do with anything. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower, and retell it in words and in touch. It is lovely, until it flowers again from within of self-blessing, as St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow, and told her in words and in touch, blessings of earth on the sow, and the sow began remembering all down her thick length, from the earthen snout all the way through the fodder and slops to the spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out of from the spine, down through the great broken heart, to the sheer blue milk and dreaminess spurting and shuddering, from the 14 teats onto the 14 mouths, sucking and blowing beneath them, the long, perfect loveliness of a sow. Well, did that take St. Francis and a sow and kind of makes everything, you know, but it's a sequence. It's a nice connection there. So the sow was a mother. The sow was a mother with 14 teats and 14 little ones. And there's many women out there that feel the same way, probably. with far less teats and little ones. Let's see. Mark Strand. Oh, boy. So let's see what we've got so far. Does it seem that we've gone from the early poems of Edward Arlington Robinson, I guess it is, from about the turn of the century, or maybe 1910, let's say 1910, to poems from the 1940s and 50s that are more, I don't know if it's a good word. What's it? What would you call it? My technician here, SFW, safe for work. No, what I mean is that they don't have the same poetry, do they? They're not lilting. They're not quite so beautiful. Oh, darn. You know what happens to me if I ever even mention anybody Irish, like St. Francis? St. Francis wasn't Irish. He was Italian. Yeah, what was he doing in Ireland? Oh, St. Pat. You mean I went through that thing with an Irish accent and I should have been Italian? I don't know how to do an Italian accent. I really don't. You know, what kind of, I don't know the words in it. Paparazzi. Hey. Avante. Avante. Okay. Mark Strand. Oh, my. I hope this isn't a sad one. If this is a sad one, then I'll stop and go on to something else. It's called My Mother on an Evening in Late Summer. When the moon appears and a few wind-stricken barns stand out in the low-domed hills, and shine with a light that is veiled and dust-filled and that floats upon the fields. My mother, with her hair in a bun, her face in shadow, and the smoke from her cigarette coiling close to the faint yellow sheen of her dress, stands near the house and watches the seepage of late night down through the sedges, the last gray islands of cloud take from view, and the wind ruffling the moon's ash-colored coat on the black bay. 2. Soon the house with its shades drawn closed will send small carpets of lamp glow into the haze in the bay, will begin its loud heaving, and the pines, frayed finials climbing the hill, will seem to graze the dim cinders of heaven. And my mother will stare into the star lanes, the endless tunnels of nothing, and as she gazes under the hour's spell, she will think how we yield each night to the soundless storms of decay, the tear at the folding flesh, and she will not know why she is here or what she is prisoner of, if not the conditions of love that brought her to this. 3. My mother will go indoors, and the fields, the bare stones, will drift in peace. Small creatures, the mouse and the swift, will sleep at opposite ends of the house. Only the cricket will be up, repeating its one shrill note to the rotten boards of the porch, to the rusted screens, to the air, to the rimless dark, to the sea that keeps to itself. Why should my mother awake? The earth is not yet a garden about to be turned. The stars that are not yet bells that ring at night for the lost. It is much too late. For the lost, it is much too late. I guess there's a sad ending here for his mother. Not sure. Well, a lot of poets have mother issues, you know what I mean? There's definitely something, sometimes. Achilles fights the river from the Iliad by Homer, by Robert Faglas. Robert Faglas, F-A-G-L-E-S. It says it's a translation. It's a translation from the Iliad by Homer, huh? That he did with, well, the Iliad, there's bound to be bravery and battle. Bravery and battle in the Iliad of for Troy, a place which now has been torn down brick by brick. They're not even sure where it even was. Achilles, the famous spearman, leaping down from the bluff, plunged in the river's heart, and the river charged against him, churning, surging, all her rapids rising in white fury, and drove the massive corpses choking tight his channel. The rock Achilles killed, Scamander heaved them up, and bellowing like a bull, the river flung them out on the dry land, but saved the living, hiding them down the fresh, clear pools of his thundering white, of his thundering whirling current. But thrashing over Achilles' shoulder raised a killer wave. The tremendous thrust of it slammed against his shield, and he staggered, lost his footing, his arms flung out for a tall, strong elm. He clung, but out of it came by the roots, toppling down, ripping away the whole cliff, blocking the stream, with a tangled snarl of branches crashing into it full length to dam the river bank to bank. Bursting up from whirlpool, Achilles dashed for the plain, his feet flying in terror. But the great god would not let up, hurling against him, Scamander looming into a murderous breaker, dark over him. I don't know who Scamander is. I guess Scamander is a god or demigod or something. Into a breaker, dark over him, dead set on stopping the brilliant Achilles' rampage here and thrusting disaster off the struggling Trojan force. But the hero sprang away, far as a hand-flung spear, swooping fast as the black eagle, the fierce marauder, both the strongest and swiftest bird that flies the sky. On he streaked, and the bronze rang out against his chest, clashing grimly. Slipping out from under the wave, he fled with the river, rolling on behind him, roaring huge as a farmhand runs a ditch from a dark spring, sluicing the gushing stream through plants and gardens, swinging his mattock to knock the clouds out down the chute. And the water rushes in, tearing the pebbles loose, and what begins a trickle hits a quick slope, and down it goes, outstripping the man who guides it. So the relentless tide kept overtaking Achilles. Yes, for all his speed, gods are stronger than men. Again and again, the brilliant, swift Achilles whirled, trying to stand and fight the river man to man and see if of all the immortal gods who ruled the vaulting skies were after him, putting him to rout. Again and again, the mighty crest of the river, fed by the rains of Zeus, came battering down his shoulders, down from high above. But Achilles kept on leaping higher, desperate now, as the river kept on dragging down his knees, lunging under him, cutting the ground from under his legs, .. Well, you know, way back, I guess I was about a junior in high school, I had to read the Iliad and the Odyssey. I don't remember that section. I don't remember at all. I don't remember a river being after him, or that it could be conflated with a god. I don't know who Scamander was. Maybe that's a modernized name for something that I don't recognize. But the idea of that river being after him, that reminds me of scenes from 2004 and 2011 in the Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami, where people were running for their lives as the tsunami, which begins like a little trickle of water, you know, kind of like got stronger and faster and higher and pretty much swept everything before it. And the same thing in 2011 in the Japan earthquake. So sometimes, I must admit, I have this strange fascination with that. And if I want something to really jolt me, I'll go on YouTube and I'll pick out, you know, Japan 2011 tsunami, and I'll look at 2 or 3 minutes or maybe 10 minutes or 20 minutes of tsunami footage and the power, the terror of nature, the unfathomable energy that it has, and the mindless or maybe partly minded, you know, necessity of destroying that man has built, you know. And very scary, very scary. Ooh, I think we need to take a break. Let's see what my... How about something happy? You mean one of my songs or one of the commercials? Maybe we have a happy song. Is there a happy song? Whistle while you work. Da-da-da-da-da. I don't know if I played Pig Ankle Rag or not. It's snappy. Why don't you play it again? Here's Pig Ankle Rag. Oh, there's some others. Okay, there's some other snappy stuff. She's probably going to pick one where I sing. Oh, you can play that. Bye bye, Blackbird. That's too quiet. Okay. Waits on you, sugar sweet, so is she. Bye bye, Blackbird. No one can more than understand me. Heart of thought they all have. So make my bed and light the light. I'll arrive late tonight. Bye-bye. Pack up all my cares and woe. Here I go
singing.
You know, there I am singing on
the
I forgot this bed. You know.
There's somebody waits for me, sugar sweet.
Hey, it's my show.
So is she by
I can barely hear it. Can you turn it up?
Plenty can love understand. Oh, what hard luck stories they all wear. Make my bed and light the light. I'll rise. Stories they all have me. Make a bed and light the light. I'll arrive late tonight. Blackbird, bye-bye.
You are listening to Freedomizer Radio, where freedomizers freedomize freedom.
Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is vaccine rights attorney and Freedomizer radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring.
How would you like to make your work more enjoyable, be more creative and relaxed, all while sitting at your desk? That's exactly what my Serenity Rug has done for me. This revolutionary footrest, I can't even call it a footrest, because this thing encourages movement of your feet, which results in more blood flow. While traditional footrests advocate the motionless placement of your feet, I found that I'm unconsciously digging my feet into the long, soft grass strands of the Serenity Rug. It delivers an incredibly relaxing sensation that closely resembles the feeling of an exotic foot massage. If you have ever had a foot massage that made you want to stay there for hours, you know what I'm talking about. If you have not heard about the Serenity Rug, check them out at SerenityRug.com and join the exclusive Serenity Rug community and enjoy a feeling of comfort and relaxation that most will never experience. They've sold out before, so I suggest you do your feet a favor and grab one of these. Again, that's SerenityRug.com.
You're an activist. You have a cause and an idea, but you also have lots of questions. You need help. After all, teams have coaches, corporations have consultants, and even politicians have campaign managers. But who do activists turn to? The Solutions Institute. We are a collection of professionals and activists from across the political spectrum. Our goal is to teach, motivate, and put all the necessary tools for activism in your hands without charge. Learn more or submit your project at solutions-institute.org.
Call in our live number at 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. Press 1 to participate on the air.
And we're back. And we're so thankful to be allowed in here as part of the Freedomizer Radio family, although I'm certainly the black sheep of this family because I don't have it. Yes, I am, because I don't really have the political, you know, outlook that a lot of people have on here. And, yeah, I do. You think so? Huh? Just because I watched some of those YouTube videos with you. Hey, I watched Sean Spicer, yeah. He didn't quite look himself today, though. What was his name? But anyway, I'm a California boy. I'm from California. And, you know, I still get things in my mailbox from the DNC and Obama. Well, not so much from Obama anymore, but I sure was for years getting stuff from Obama. And I have no, pardon? You put it in the spam? Ah. Yeah, no, I'm not even going to go there, because I've already learned that, you know, people are very sensitive about this subject. So, but what happens around me does not concern me when it comes to the radio show. Although I really have to, I'm very impressed with Suzanne's show that follows mine, Mad Scientists Exposed. As somebody says on there, it's not science that we trust science. It's scientists we don't trust, because some of these scientists have their own agenda, and they want to get money? Don't they want to score some brownie points, you know, for their side? Oh boy. Well, don't get me started with Bill Nye, the science guy, so-called science. Maybe it'll come up, huh? Fake science, yeah. So I think he's on the wrong side of several issues, and I just can't stand what he's doing on Netflix right now with his new show. Is bringing out singers like, I can't remember her name, Rachel somebody. Yeah, Rachel who? Bloom, Rachel Bloom, yeah, who is dancing and singing songs that seem to be aimed at young teenagers and talking about various kinds of sex and seducing a boy and shaking her boobs in his face and all that stuff. It's just outrageous. It's just outrageous where we've gone as a society, with 52 different genders and gender pronouns and stuff like that. I think it's just great. But listen, I never get into politics here, okay? Never get into politics. Never, never. You won't hear me say anything like that on the air. I'm better off with, the closest I get to politics is that I have a book like Something for My Fathers, is by John McCain, and it's autographed. Why do I get these autographed books by some? Yeah, I also have Romney's book, but I can't even remember the title on that one. But these were not winning books, because these guys did not win. They wrote the books, but it didn't help them win any elections, unfortunately. But I get some autographed books by people that are very strange, like Herbert Hoover, who took us through the start of the Great Depression, and he was blamed for the Depression by the time Roosevelt, won the office in late 1932. So but I like autographed books. Autographed books always have some extra value. I have about 20 or 30 autographed books by people that I've never heard of. I've never heard of them, and probably you have not heard of them either, because maybe this was their one book that they did. Maybe they wrote their name in every single copy of every book that they that they ever published. But anyway, sometimes the books are worth $10 or $20 more, just because they're autographed by an author that nobody really knows anymore. But they could be worth $1,000 more if they're autographed by, some of the best authors. Hemingway's more than that, Sinclair Lewis and, some of the great Southern playwrights, William Faulkner, your famous authors. You get a book signed by a famous author, it's worth some money. Then again, I have three books autographed by Anne Rice in her Lasher Vampire series. And I think that the autograph book is probably makes it worth a little bit less than a book that isn't autographed, because the autograph is always in a broad felt tip marker that just about ruins the page it's on. I don't know why she wanted to use a broad felt tip marker. Seems very egocentric to me to do that. But be that as it may, yeah, there are lots of books of hers out, because she went to lots of book shows and signings, and every time she talked in front of a library, or a Barnes & Noble, she had dozens of people that wanted their copies signed, and she signed them. There are some authors who don't sign their books that much, who just don't like to autograph books or give autographs in general, and they're worth like 10 times more because nobody has their autograph. They're for everything, which is what keeps the market going, even through recessions and depressions. There are always collectors out there that want books, every book that they can find on a subject like teddy bears or dolls or Joe DiMaggio or Marilyn Monroe or Albert Einstein. In fact, I think there was a play that came out with those last three characters in the play. Although I forgot what the play is called. That's right. Joe DiMaggio, Marilyn Monroe, and Albert Einstein. Maybe somebody else, too. I don't know. And the host would have been good. Mae West, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, somebody like that. So that's a love of books that has always been there, and that's what makes your book, if you have one like that, always going to be worth something. And over a period of time, we find that these books go up in value. When I first got into the book business in about the mid-1980s, I mean, for real, in the 1980s, I would say prices of books were about one-fourth or one-fifth of what they are right now. So maybe you can say the same for real estate, right? I mean, you know, how much has real estate gone up in the last 30 years to 35 years? And maybe the same kind of thing has happened with collectibles, not just books, but collectibles of all kinds. So I love the subject, and if you want to find out more, contact me through edaugustsbooks.com. That's www.edaugustsbooks.com, and there will be a radio listen page, and there's a form that you can access on there where you can ask a question, or there's also a comment page. You know, feel free to make a comment, and you know, maybe we can even do some business. Do you want to buy a book? Do you want to sell a book? Well, hey, what's going on? In my last couple of shows, I've given advice on which services to use when you want to sell your collection. I wouldn't advise having a moving sale or a yard sale or a garage sale or, you know, those kind of estate sale. Well, good luck on an estate sale if you're still alive, right? You could call it an estate sale, I guess, if it's, you know, other people's stuff. But you just can't get nearly the money that your stuff is worth. But I cannot also advise going in to visit a shop, going to visit an antique shop, because they like to get stuff for cheap, too. I've just heard recent stories of people who have taken valuable jewelry into jewelers that they thought were really good jewelers, you know, and they're given terrible prices, the thing is the jeweler would like to have that piece. If he could trade it for something, if he could say, well, if you could just drop it off here for a couple of hours when I can go through, well, then when the person comes back a couple hours later, I'm not saying that this happens commonly, but there's a chance that it might be traded for something, that a diamond could be traded for a lesser, you know, cut piece of glass. Someone took a chip out my my friend's mother or grandmother. Grandmother had a jeweler steal a gem out of one of her diamond brooches, or what was it? A ring out of a ring. That's a nasty piece of goods, is a jeweler that steals like that. That's terrible. So, anyways, the market is fascinating. There's always a market. There's always buyers, unless a person just has boring stuff. I was once called out to, I was in Canada at the time, and somebody said I should go out to Mississauga, which is at the end of the subway line. I didn't have a car at the time. Said to walk about four blocks. Got to this house. The guy had told me on the phone back at the bookstore that he had about 1,000 books that were 100 years old. So, you know, I should have asked him to go get one. As a matter of fact, I think I did. He said, no, I'm too busy. I can't really do that right now. So I walked his house. It took me about an hour and a half to get there. His wife answers the door and says, oh, yeah, they're in the garage. So I go in the garage, and what there is a pile of about 100 to 200 Reader's Digest condensed books dating from, you know, like the 1970s and 80s. And I just, this is the books? This is the books that he called me? Oh, man. Well, I didn't want to make a big scene in front of her. But, you know, she could tell I was very discouraged disappointed because I left promptly. And, you know, people shouldn't say they have 1,000 books that are 100 years old when what they have is 200 books that are 20 or 30 years old, you know. That is the heart of over-exaggeration. there's a warm spot in hell for that guy, as far as I'm concerned. Because if he did that to me, he probably did worse to many other people. So, but it's still fun. It's still fun going out and looking at books. I personally like to get in on the ground floor. The ground floor is nobody else has seen the books. I go out there, I can make an offer for some or all of the books. Sometimes they just want to get everything out of there because to them it's junk. And so, okay, I don't mind. You know, I can have friends. I get boxes. I get a larger vehicle. And I get the stuff out of there, you know. I don't mind doing that at all to get at some books that might be worth as much as the house is worth, you know. They just see them as junk. That's a repeated refrain that you'll hear me use again and again if you can, if you want good collectible stuff, find a don't-wanter. Find somebody who thinks their stuff is junk, that reminds them too much of their uncle or their grandfather, and they never did like that old guy. And to them, the stuff that he liked is total junk. It could be he could have had, you know, like the first folio collection of Shakespeare, but to him, it's freaking junk. And I've seen many people put books out on the sidewalk. You know, they have these days, these certain days, you know, when in certain cities and counties where trucks come by and pick up the junk, you know, so they put, like, what is it called? Like a big refuse day or something like that. So a friend of mine called me. I was at home. She said, "Ed, get over to Benton Street at such and such a block. There's a huge pile of really good-looking old philosophy books and stuff like that." So, okay, I was there in 5 minutes. Nobody beat me to it. And I looked, and these were all books about India. Almost all of them were about India, the sutras, the Gitas, the Upanishads, the great masters of the East, you know, editions in their dust jackets going back to before 1900 on this subject, books that were published in London, books that were published in Paris, books that were published in Mumbai, and Delhi and places like that, books on astrology. Well, anyway, I loaded everything that I could. Maybe I took everything. I don't know. It was a lot of books. And it took me probably 3 or 4 years to get rid of those, to sell the books, to put them out at retail, but I did. And I wrote a book about this, which you can access. Gee, where is it? I guess it's on lulu.com. It's called Get Rich Buying at Yard Sales. Get Rich Buying at Yard Sales by Ed August. I think it came out in 2008, 2009. I'm going to do a revised copy at some point. And if you can't find that ebook or that paperback book, then let me know. I will surely have it reissued in a hurry. It has in there probably 100 different types of collectibles. It tells how to do it, where to look for them, etc. I think it's a popular book, very popular. And with that popularity comes the end of an hour and a half. I don't know how I got through an hour and a half because I was just reading out of books and talking off the top of my head. But here we are, and here's my exit music. And I wish that you will come back and see me again. I'll be back. I'll be back tonight with my astrology show. Then I'll be back with this one next Tuesday at 3 p.m. California time, 6 p.m. Eastern time. And now for some exit music. Guys, please, right here. Okay.